Let me say how thrilled I am to be with you. I've dropped into your group from time to time over the years and been a little closer and been very impressed with what I've heard. So be prepared for a ride this morning. I've got a lot of information that I'm going to give to you fairly quickly. Consider it something like hopping on a train and going over a terrain that works to give an underpinning to the first six, or really seven chapters, and to what is coming next week with Reverend Smith coming to talk to us about mystical states. Bob Deering called me on Monday and said, oops, sorry, the author really wants to talk about what we'd asked you to talk about, but could you do something else about the mystical states? And I said, well, actually, I'll just take the side piece that I was going to develop, these margin notes that Martha talked about, and I'll show some of the biological underpinnings of what for us are prayer and mystical states. So here we go. I think the real reason that I was invited to join this series is because I gave dinner to Ken Wilber and his wife Treya in 1985. And I'll tell you more about that supper if you would like to ask questions about it in our little chatting time. But Ken Wilber produced in 1995 an enormous opus, the sum of all the books that he had written up to that time and the foundation for all the books that followed. This one is, I think, yes, a brief history of everything. But his opus, which is this thick, was called Sex, Ecology, and Spirituality. And it laid out the enormous framework that Paul Smith has found so useful in exploring the history of religion and Christianity. Ken was a wonderful dinner guest. You can imagine how much fun the conversation was. And I discovered him to be a generous, sincere, real, whole human being who was shatteringly brilliant. And his mastery of these major fields of knowledge has allowed him to integrate their meanings into a framework that reveals the level of consciousness that produced all that philosophy, psychology, and science. Now, my reading of a lot of those same fields looked a lot like this: flat information, lists of dates, lists of concepts and ideas. And I was quite satisfied with that kind of that flat level of information. But as I began to know Wilber and read his work, I found that, that it literally lifted off the page into the stages of consciousness that produced those same ideas. So now they were no longer flat and as a list, but they are alive and they are evolving above all. They are all evolving. Now, Wilber's paradigm has a number of names, and I will read these off. Archaic consciousness, tribal consciousness, traditional consciousness, modernist consciousness, postmodernist consciousness, where we are now, integral, where we're heading, post-integral, who knows. But there is another spiral that is even more explicit. This is the spiral that Smith uses. And he talks about these stages as churches in chapters 1 through 6. The first stage is the archaic stage, so ancient that all we have left are the paintings on the caves of Lascaux, done in some form of reverence and awe and worship. The next stage is the tribal stage, where the gods that were worshipped were power gods, gods of the sun. The next stage that Smith talks about and that Wilber unfolds is the warrior stage. The next stage that they speak about is the modernist stage, the stage of our great-great-grandparents. Out of that, became the, I'd say, the Reformation, the stage below the traditional stage, is the stage in which the temples of the Israelis emerged, the cathedrals of the Catholic religion emerged, the institutional church as we know it was traditional. The modernist church spread out and reformed. The postmodern church moved into zillions of different denominations. And finally, the tier that we're moving into is looking as if it's going someplace else entirely, maybe all the way back to the beginning with churches. Last week, Jim Clark walked us through the Bible as an evolutionary development. So as you look at these colors, you'll see, and spirals, you'll see that you can locate the Old Testament from the warrior and tribal spirals at the bottom up to the traditionalist, and including the traditionalist spires. The New Testament begins with the traditionalist church and moves all the way up through the modernist church, but it is beginning to be left behind, that traditional church, in this newest iteration of consciousness. Now, there's another way to look at this framework of evolving consciousness. There is a record of our planet's evolution that's been laid down in the cells and brains of everyone sitting here in this room. We all began life as a pair of single cells, meeting and multiplying madly. We all looked like a little apostrophe in our mother's womb. The big part of it was our head. The little tail was our tail. That head slowly began to evolve eyes and then gills. It was clearly the head that we were destined to have. And as those eyes and gills grew, a little nose and a mouth appeared. The gills left, and the little tail became the spine, which became the skeleton that enclosed the beginnings of a tiny circulatory system. All the little organs that were present in the first mammals that ever walked the earth are present in this tiny fetus that we were in our mother's womb. Eventually, small appendages grow out on either side of this little tail body of ours. They look a lot like the legs of the salamander, ready to climb out on land. Clearly, we're destined for air sometime in the future and land sometime in the future. But always preeminent in the growth of the fetus is that big head, larger by far in relationship to anything else in the body. It is the seat of our consciousness, which turns out to be the point of the entire exercise. And at 9 months, at 9 months, we appear, having moved through the entire cycle of animal to human life on Earth. We wake up with big brains on wobbly little necks, hard to hold up, but they are wired with programs of intelligence timed to unfold across an entire lifetime. Now, our parents had no idea this is what went on with their babies in utero. It's really only since the late 50s and early 60s that we've had the science and the technology to photograph these stages. Remember Leonard Nielsen's book when it first came out on the market and how thrilled we were to see these images? Well, just before that, in the 50s, there were a few observant humans beginning to realize that human growth is in stages. Jean Piaget in France charted the fact that all children grew at about the same rate through exactly the same stages. All children evolved the same way. Erickson over here in the U.S. began to pick that up and tell us that adults also grow in stages. We continue to evolve across a lifetime. Abraham Maslow and Claire Graves were beginning to look at the broad consciousness of our culture, and they were determining that, yes, there were stages of consciousness that could be seen to be evolving. Well, things really began to grow in the 1980s when Joe Bogan down in L.A. split the first brain of his epileptic patient who was had a life-threatening kind of epilepsy. Bogan had to cut into the corpus callosum and literally sever all the connections between the two lobes of the neocortex. But what a surprise. In subsequent tests to see if his patient could still think and talk, he discovered that indeed he was whole and human, but he handled information very differently. With his left brain, he was analytical and logical, precise, repetitive, organized, detailed, scientific. You can read the rest. With his right brain, creative, imaginative, a generalized way of looking at things, intuitive, conceptual, big picture, heuristic, empathetic, figurative, and wonderfully irregular. Those are the two sides of the neocortex that are fused in our own thinking processes and that we use every day. But on the East Coast, at the same time, the director of the National Institute of Mental Health, Dr. Paul McLean, who I have had the pleasure to meet a few times and who is one of the funniest individuals I have ever met, as the head of a very serious area, they were dissecting the brain and discovering that below the neocortex lie two other structures of the human brain, utterly different in structure and in cellular quality. The first one, no surprise, is the brain of the old reptilian complex. This was the brain that dominated planet Earth for most of its whirls around the sun. A second brain emerged to wrap around it that has all the characteristics, the neural characteristics of the mammalian brain. And then on top of those brains is layered this brand new brain, the neocortex, that Joe Bogan split. And that accounts for the arisal of the human being, Homo sapien, the one who knows that he knows. Now, let me just run through these different brains and give you a chance to get familiar with yourself within your own brain. If you look for a moment at that little brown donut, the reptilian brain, right in the middle, that is bears the neural circuitries for a limited awareness that allows the species to survive. This is the survival brain. It is aware entirely of its own territory for safety's sake. But in the big brain, it translates as our personal space, our home space. I bet you some of you even return to the same side of this auditorium every time you come in. This is coming from the very middle of your heads. Implanted in this old brain is the neural circuitry for dominance. Our dogs, we call it the alpha state. In humans, we call it leaders and followers, but it all begins in this oldest brain. This oldest brain, for safety's sake, employs imitative behavior and its, quote, relationships with others. There are no relationships between reptiles and dinosaurs and lizards, but there are ways of mimicking the behavior of the neighbor so that you don't get eaten up. That imitative behavior in the human brain becomes conformity. Fads, fashions. Rituals are also a part of this oldest brain. You do the same kinds of things in a ritual way to be safe. Rituals repeat, of course, for safety's and worship's sake in our own brains. This is also the brain of migration, again, for safety, finding the new place that's safe. In humans, it became our tribal wandering, and for us, we do it for fun. Finally, the last and most important one, or one of the most important neural treats in this brain, is its capacity for deception as a strategy for survival. It has also survived in the new brain. I think of the deceptive policies that we ourselves employ at work, in politics, in sex. These are some of the links between these oldest intelligences and the big brain on top. If you look in the very middle of the brain, you're looking at the mammalian brain. What a change it brings to the evolution of God's creatures. This is the brain of sexual procreation for the first time. Sexuality, mating, becomes possible, and out of that, of course, becomes the family unit, the clan, the tribe, the nation, all of our senses of governance. That's embedded in that middle brain. Also in that brain is the seat of emotion. Primitive emotion begins to arise here, which becomes wonderfully vitalized and refined at the human level. This is the brain whose capacity for relationship is the foundation for all our culture. It is also the neural circuitry for personal identification. There is a sense of self in this brain and among animals, as you know. In the human, it grows into the ego. Memory. A very primitive memory is embedded right around our ears, and it still is the case that when we hear or smell something, it tends to remain in our memory stream longer than mere facts that come in at the top of our head. We can thank our middle brain for that. And finally, playfulness. Playfulness comes on board with this brain. Think of the monkeys, think of the dogs, think of the bears. They all play in absolute safety. Even enemies play unless they have to do something else for survival's sake. What a wonderful gift we've gotten in our new brain. We don't do it nearly enough. We've forgotten a little bit about, I think, playfulness. And finally, at the top, we've already discovered what the left and the right brain are capable of. Now, you can see that the carrying cases, the luggage for this brain, has changed across time. Just look at the foreheads, and you'll see that rather flat to begin with, and slowly the brain grows and pushes forward further and further. Most of this is happening during the archaic stage, but at the very, very last, within about the last maybe 8,000 years, the brain is pushed forward to make this straight, almost bumped out part of our skull. Paul MacLean calls this the penthouse. And the penthouse of the brain has a whole new set of circuitries that simply did not exist about 8,000 years ago. He calls this brain, He calls this brain the angel brain. We've got it. This is a sensitive little... I'll be careful. Thank you. The angel brain. There are actually neural circuitries that have been identified behind your forehead for the following programs of intelligence. And these are the programs that I nickname spiritual intelligence. They are empathy, precognition, compassion, intuition, insight, altruism. Well, I've got intuition twice. the angel brain programs are not easily accessible. We seldom access these areas of the brain, but they are fully fledged when we move into the mystical states that Reverend Smith is going to be talking to us about next week, and that I'm going to tell you a little bit about the underpinnings and what they bring to our spiritual church-going lives. Yes. Joseph Chilton Pierce calls what I just described to you the biology of transcendence. Our bodies and brains have been designed to evolve upwards and inwards. And the thoughtful minds of the psalmists actually spoke to this. What is mankind that you are mindful of them? Human beings that you care for them? You have made them little lower than the angels and crowned them with glory and honor. We are wired for levels of intelligence that we still hardly use. we've also been wired to be the creators of our own culture. Culture is an artifact of our consciousness. Let me say that again. Our culture is an artifact of our own consciousness. We create and behave from the level of our consciousness. We make it ourselves. Our culture is our collective lifestyle. We all live unquestioningly by its core values and laws. They are, after all, the core values and laws that we've set down ourselves. We share a common understanding about territories and boundaries, which we've set up ourselves. We've decreed what's beautiful and ugly, what's good and what's bad. We have found a way to understand God. We found a way to do business. We create our culture on the basis of our understanding of things. But a culture takes a long time to develop its shared identity, its rules and practices, to slowly catch on to the main ideas, to turn them into habits so that everybody is operating along the same wavelength, until finally those habits begin to constrict us a little, begin to chafe a little bit at them. We begin to want to grow out of them. Changing from one culture to the next is not exactly unlike our children outgrowing an old set of clothes. Only it happens unlike the few months, especially that your grandchildren and mine are going through right now. It can take eons. So let's go back and look again at Ken Wilber's and Paul Smith's spiral of cultural consciousness. And let's estimate some of the timelines here. The archaic level of consciousness appeared 100,000 years ago. That scraggly band of survivalists who scavenged and roamed a way of life that just kept them alive eventually became successful enough in their skills to emerge into another level of consciousness, tribal consciousness, which began to emerge about 40,000 years ago. Roaming still, but having discovered an agrarian relationship with your Mother Earth that allowed them to eat more frequently and better. More children stayed alive. They began to grow in numbers. And eventually, about 30,000 years ago, the warrior culture began to emerge, when these same people were numerous enough to stake a claim on the territory. Think of the Israelites coming into Cana and beginning to stake their claims and finding, what? That someone else was claiming that as well. And what happened next? The endless, ceaseless era of aggression that we call the warrior culture. Nevertheless, about 20,000 years later, notice things are beginning to speed up. A traditional form of culture began to emerge because people were really settling down. Territory was established and named. People belonged to a kingdom, to a group of villages. They eventually belonged, as time went on, to whole nations. And within these kingdoms and villages, ways of doing things emerged. They were called laws, ways of worshiping, no longer mythic gods, but especially with the Israelites, who had a genius for God right from the beginning. They established ways of worship. These were all laid down as the traditions of the people. What's interesting to us is to see how early these traditions arose and how long and stable they have been, because we're still essentially following many of these traditional patterns with our own consciousness as a culture. 500 years ago, that great traditional culture got a little too small in the shoulders, and it began to grow out into the modernist era. You can see that the orange cycle is turning into the green cycle. This is the modernist era, when simple technologies, those great clocks in the cathedrals, extensive trading, adventurous voyages, gave us the new world, gave us the first simple democracies, gave us capitalism, and reformed the entire church. 150 years ago, we're really speeding up now, the postmodern era emerged, with social democracies arising out of the old constitutional democracies, with new communications of telephone and radio beginning to vastly diminish space and time. Trade and industry began to thrive and indeed take over as the chief values of that particular era. The postmodern began to change, though it's still very much with us, about 50 years ago, into something that we're only just beginning to be able to define. We saw it arise in the 60s, that great upwelling. And it had predecessors, of course, at least 50 years before that, in, say, the League of Nations, the United Nations, the global economy we're experiencing today, and the World Wide Web. The second part of Paul Smith's title is The Spirit's Call to Evolve. This is what it looks like collectively, en masse. This is what those first six chapters of the book are meant to unfold for you. But I thought perhaps if you could kind of see it and hear some of the stories attended, that you would have this now as a permanent basis for understanding where we're going to go next. The great stages of human consciousness are slow. They have to be earned. They take a long time to move through. But the states of human consciousness are fast. Those states are, broadly speaking, sleeping and waking and deep sleep. Waking is called the gross state of consciousness. Sleeping is called the subtle state of consciousness. Deep sleeping is called the causal state of consciousness. Now, our waking state is just what I've been describing. We awake within the conscious awareness of our culture. Some people talk about that as, quote, sleepwalking or automatic living, which, in fact, it is in terms of our personal development. But it serves us well. We're all conversant with it, and this constitutes what is our waking state. When you begin to think about it from this point of view, it begins to feel a little different, doesn't it? Because there's a little more utility, I think, to these ideas. Now, our sleeping state gives us that dreaming state first, the REM sleep, that rapid eye movement sleep that is subtle. And that is one of the reasons why this particular state is called a subtle state. We're asleep. We're dreaming. Different dreams are coming and glowing. Images are coming and sometimes sounds. A lot of it may be psychological house cleaning, which is what I think a good deal of dreaming is. Sometimes it brings a great message to us, which we want to wake up and transcribe. Dreams are messengers of God. Not all of them. But many of them are. And yet, at some point in every night, we go into that boneless sleep of deep sleep when everything is released. We've stopped thinking. We've stopped holding our skeletons upright. We have lost ourselves, literally, in the deep sea of causal consciousness. Scientists sort of have awakened and been surprised to note that, well, this is absolutely essential. If you don't have deep sleep, you will die. And indeed, we will. We must touch down into this deep causal realm. And we do so once or twice every 24-hour period. Now, this deep sleep, this causal state, can be, as the dreaming state can also be, accessed when our eyes are wide open. In the daytime, if you step out of your ordinary cultural consciousness awareness, you begin to experience the same circumstances of your living in a very different way. When you are able to move into these subtle states, things come together, just the way St. Paul said, all things come together for good for those who love the Lord. Now, that's a sweet aphorism, and it's one I've loved and taught my children and all my students. But in fact, there is great cognitive brain truth and heart truth to this, as you will see as we move along this morning. All things do indeed come together in synchronicity, in coincidence. Words that we use to apply to this odd juxtaposition of circumstance and situation when we are seeing things differently from a state that is closer to the causal state. We have a kind of influence on the reality that is beginning to arise in front of our eyes. Now, we accidentally fall into this, it seems to us, that, gee, all of a sudden I just had a great day, or I had a whole series of coincidences. Athletes experience it as the zone. You know, the basketball players talk about it. My sister, who is or was a really ace tennis player, she got all the athleticism in the family, believe me, and at age 50 was playing with her Pasadena tennis club back east in the senior women's tennis open and Forest Hills, and they won. And it was in that game that she had a peak experience, and she came home eager to share it with me. She said, there I was with my partner just starting the match, and all of a sudden things began to slow down all around me. I could see the seams on the tennis ball as it came toward me. I had all the time in the world to put my racket back, to cock it at just the angle I wanted, to envision it going across the net, and I would, in slow motion, whack that sucker, she said, across the net, and they couldn't return it. She played the entire game out in this exquisite, joyful, confident, slow motion zone, and they won stunningly. She came home and put her tennis racket aside. She never played tennis again because, a little like the fulfillment of those cultural stages of consciousness, she had done it. She had fulfilled the tennis potential. And then she took up golf. Another word for this state is the flow state. That's what Mozart called it. He talked about the flow of presence and music in his life. He never figured out what he wanted to write. He didn't say to himself, oh, I think I'm going to do a sonata today, perhaps a minuet tomorrow, maybe a little concerto by Friday. No. He simply sat down at the piano, and we have this in his own handwriting, in his own letters. I simply sat down, he said. Maybe this is the way you play your guitar, Tom. But I just sat down, put my hands on the keys, and the music poured into my head, out through my fingers. I did not know what I was going to play, but I played it, and I stopped, and I wrote it down. Then I played some more, and I stopped, and I wrote it down. Mozart composed in the flow state, an unparalleled outpouring of genius-level music. This same subtle state happens, however, in other arenas. In chemistry, for instance, in the mid-19th century, Kekule, the great chemist, was chasing the chemical structure of the benzene molecule. Now, all chemical structures of molecules were great chains, some of them quite long, some of them short, some of them stacked, but this one would not yield its secrets to him. And finally, at the end of like the eighth month, he sat back, having hit the wall again at the end of the day, decided to sit in front of his fireplace. He sat back in his easy chair. He lowered his eyelids, took a deep breath, and just watched the flames. And as he watched the flames, one flame sort of leaped out and looked like a little line of flame. And it opened its mouth, and it grabbed the tail of another little flame that leaped out, which grabbed the tail of another little flame that leaped out, until it looked like there was a little spinning circle of little flame-like snakes. And he woke up and realized that the structure of the benzene molecule was not a chain. It was a ring. Subtle states are creative states. They are musical states. They are athletic states. Of course, they are holy states, and we're going to be doing lots more about that in the next week. But I want to point out to you that they exist in your own lives, and you know it. How many of you have experienced this state of wonderful well-being and connection in gardening or in nature? Anybody like me? Yes. Any of you still surf or did surf for a while? The surfer experiences this regularly. The jogger experiences it. The artist does. It is estimated that 75% of all American people have had a mystical experience, and many of them closely associated with the divine. There we go. And now that brings us to the still awake state, but experiencing these subtle states. We are now plunging past subtle to causal. And this is what happens in the meditative state. Looking out at you, I feel certain that there are a lot of centering prayer people here, Christ consciousness prayer people here, people who learned TM. That's how I first learned it, because I couldn't find out how to meditate from any of my own churches. The questions, the spiritual questions about consciousness and prayer that I was asking in the late 50s and 60s and could never find answers to from any priest or minister, by the mid-70s were being advertised in the classifieds in the New York Times. It was that fast. This information has simply made itself known. The Spirit's call to evolve has had a big answer. So slowly, most of us have come to this level of prayer, though it's not well understood, and in many churches there's a good deal of suspicion for it, unfortunately. Nevertheless, this is the straight skinny from a research position, which tells us that this is a state that drops in deeply into the causal. When we consider the Bible stories about Jesus moving away from the crowds with frequency to pray, I don't think he was saying the Lord's Prayer, though he might have started with it, but I believe that he was sitting something like this, so deeply connected to the divine, to the universe, to everything around him, that he was recharged, remade, and able to come back and face these much lower levels of consciousness and to try to entice them, to play with them, to come forward and taste some of the new levels that he was bringing them. The 1960s, you'll hear me coming back to this again and again, experienced this great upwelling of cultural change. This is my old friend, Sister Corita Kent. I don't know how many of you knew Corita, but she befriended me in wonderful ways in my own teaching career, and we kept our friendship up over the years. I think this is a beautiful example of the yearning in the early 60s for love, for God, for transcendent states, for wonder. There is the girl herself, and there is her art. doesn't it bring it back to all of you just to see wonder, heart, I love shimmering there? Well, the Spirit's call is to evolve. And our personal evolution undoubtedly lies in practicing these higher states. We're on a slow escalator, slowly moving up in our culture, though we've hit a particularly toxic time in our postmodern to global culture that needs a good deal of cleaning up. But as Ken says, if we are serious about personal evolution, there is one, and really only one, fast way to it. And it is through these higher frequency states, through meditation in particular, dropping down into that causal realm, which is the core, the fire of all creativity, out of which all manifestation comes. And we are re-manifest each time we move into that deep causal area. This is my favorite image of mystical states. This is a medieval peasant who is seeing another reality with his mystic's eyes. It's not his real eyes that are looking at this space that he has clawed open with his hand and is peeking his head out to see. No, he's looking at it with another set of eyes, with another frequency of awareness. Because inside his head and his chest, his brain and his heart are holding hands, allowing him to see a different reality. Now, the heart has long been intuited as the entry point to the divine. Another medieval monk, Saint Theophane of the Recluse, wrote, "Find a place in your heart and speak there with the Lord. It is the Lord's reception room." The heart functions in a gross bodily way. It is the pump that keeps us alive. It is the master beat to which all our cells and organs and even our skeletons move and relate to. It keeps us going in line, in alignment, 24/7. But the heart is also a brain. The heart is threaded with millions of neurons. There are as many brain neurons in the heart as there are in the two older brains that we were just talking about. The heart converses with the brain through these neurons. It functions part of the time, well, all of the time, in its physical mode. And at the same time, the heart is emitting another level of reality altogether. The subtle mode. The heart is the underpinning of this. We thought it was the brain. I'm now giving you the final secret of the mystical process. It is the heart. Every heartbeat throws out an energy field. This is what your energy field looks like. We are sitting in energy fields that are first about 3 feet from our bodies, and then, in their furthest extension, about 15 feet from our bodies. I'm looking at you. You're all sitting in each other's fields, and you didn't even know it. You are, whether you realize it or not, even as grossly unconscious as we are, subtly feeling and influencing each other, especially if you were all to reach out and hold hands, as some churches do when we pray the Lord's Prayer. For that moment, your heart signatures, if you were all reading out on EKG graphs, would be almost the same. And then the link is broken, and you're back to your own irregular heartbeat. Now, the signature of the heart is found on EKG charts. The heart writes with the pen of the EKG instrument. And as you'll see here, are three heart states. The heart receives information from the brain and all of the rest of the body, and it transmits immediately back certain signals to support the well-being of any portion of the human being. For instance, if the human being suddenly has had a bad day at the office, comes home steaming, this is what the heart signature looks like. This is what anger looks like. It's what anxiety looks like. These sharp, high edges, up and down and up and down. The whole body is slightly tensed. Cortisol is streaming through the system. The heart is readying you for fight or flight when we're anxious. Things are a little calmer when we're stressed, but it's a signature that looks not far from this. And yet, note what the heart signature looks like at rest. Just relaxed. That's its own ordinary, unique signature. But look in the middle. If I got that, no, sorry, look at the bottom. I'm using another chart. At the very bottom, the heart is in a coherent mode. You'll note that the highs and the lows are virtually the same. It is in a beautiful, almost sine wave-like rhythm. Stable, extremely alert, ready to support anything. This happens in an atmosphere of positiveness. In this instance, it comes in a mode of appreciation. Whenever we experience gratitude, awe, beauty, love, happiness, our heart wave is coherent. Now, the heart's IQ is not like the brain's IQ. The brain's intelligence is linear. It's verbal. The heart's intelligence has a holistic capability that responds only and always to the in the interest of the well-being of the body and the mind. When the heart state is coherent, something very interesting happens to the brain. You may be surprised to learn that the heart wave trumps the brain wave every time. This is what the orbital loop between heart and brain actually looks like in the chart. You can see that those are little nerve pathways that you're looking at in the chart. They go up and they come down. The heart is transmitting to the brain is transmitting to the heart. And when they are transmitting in ordinary time, it looks like the top graph. This is what our daily interaction between heart and brain look like. This is perfectly healthy. These two little clocks have their little pendulums, their little wave-making mechanisms, and you'll see that they are swinging somewhat opposite of one another. That's the way the heart and the brain often are. They serve us well in these states. This is the state of ordinary obstructed consciousness. This is our ordinary waking state. This is what the heart signature looks like. But when the heart is coherent, has reached that state of oneness or state of absolute safety and confidence, it pulls the brain wave into line with it. So that heart and brain entrain together. And when that happens, an amazing thing occurs. First of all, when we say peace to each other, this is what peace looks like. This is what serenity looks like. This is what vibrant, flourishing health, mental health looks like. Now, when our heart is entrained in this manner, it can open all the gates to these prefrontal lobes up here behind our forehead. The heartbeat, remember, is a frequency all to itself. That's what a frequency looks like. This is, again, what it projects. This great shimmering field of energy around us that we are as yet unable to sense much into. But the heart frequency combines all the information from the brain, all the information from the body, into this one extraordinarily high megahertz frequency. And, excuse me, as it projects into these great subtle body fields, they act as a hologram so that they can be accessed at any point in the field, and all of the information of the system is available. I think of Jesus fully awake, fully extended into this vast knowing, this energetic knowing. No wonder he knew who was coming before, toward him before he saw them. No wonder he could feel the coming tug on his robe from a woman he hadn't seen. He was reading the universe. He was reading the people around him because he was awake within these subtle areas, and the gates were wide open to the angel brain, and he was working constantly through those programs of intelligence to deal with, to teach, to heal, to forecast. The heart, the field of the heart, knows everything. When it's entrained with the brain, it accesses all those angel brain programs, and we move into the states that have been written about in the Gospels and the New Testament. Flammarion's engraving a last time. Here is this young medieval mystic whose heart is steadily coherent, in phase. He is undergirded and stabilizing what would ordinarily be a fleeting mystical moment. But he is able to sustain it and permit a more awakened living and working life. In our own time, when we deliberately take conscious control of our thinking, automatic, cultural conscious intelligence and brain, and when we slow it down, so that we begin to move into those feeling, heightened feeling and thinking states, the orbital brain-heart loop entrains. We're suddenly privy to a flow of information and potential that we are completely unable to see in our ordinary life. When those gateways are open with a coherent heart and this steady spiritual practice, the access to steady compassion gives us a Gandhi or a Mother Teresa. When the access through these angel brain programs allows insight to flow, we meet a Cynthia Bourgeault or a Richard Rohr. When paradox suddenly makes sense, we get an Einstein. When disparate ideas and information that never match up ordinarily suddenly fall into a great scheme of understanding, we get a Paul Smith or a Ken Wilber. When these states become finally consistent, this is what life looks like through those mystic eyes. Julian of Norwich wrote, "See, I am God. See, I am in everything. See, I never lift my hands from my works, nor will I ever. See, I lead everything toward the purpose for which I ordained it, without beginning, by the same power, wisdom, and love by which I created it. How could anything be amiss? All shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well." Mystical states. Thank you.